Good morning, everyone. We're going to convene today's Revenue Committee meeting, and we're going to start today by finishing off testimony from three bills that I'm going to open simultaneously concerning tobacco products and finish testimony that we were unable to hear last time we met. So I'm going to open House Bill 2110, House Bill 2231, and House Bill 2533. All of these bills concern tobacco tax proposals, and I'm going to basically ask people who had already signed up, and we think we marked off those that didn't, and get them up here first. So okay, Stephanie Sweet, is she here? Yeah, I've got you. Karen Gillette, are you? Oh, scratch her off. Mark Nystrom, no. Brett Hamilton. There we go. And Raquel. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Please, committee members, I think you remember these bills. I don't think we need to repeat their particulars, and I think these folks were prepared to speak to them the other day, and I apologize that we didn't complete. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you very much for your time again this morning. My name is Chair Berger and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association in Oregon, and I believe you're getting my testimony now, so I'll just hit the highlights again. But the American Heart Association's mission is to build healthier lives free of cardiovascular disease and stroke. And we strongly support each of these measures before you today. We're especially in favor of policies that direct a significant portion of any revenue raised to tobacco cessation and prevention programs, as well as healthcare services. And the main points of my testimony actually highlight the health impacts of smoking, which I know that you are well aware of. We heard a little bit about last week, but tobacco-related diseases are still the number one cause of death in Oregon. They're actually also a big contributor to long-term disability, as they cause stroke and other forms of diseases. And they have the biggest impact on kids, we know, and so we're obviously really concerned about kids becoming addicted to smoking. There are currently 74,000 kids in Oregon under 18 and alive today who will ultimately die prematurely from smoking-related diseases. And just a couple of the health impacts. Smoking causes coronary heart disease, the leading cause of death in the United States. It's been associated with sudden cardiac arrest of all types in both men and women. Congestive heart failure is the third leading cause of death. Stroke, as I mentioned, which is the third leading cause of death in Oregon. We actually have a really high incidence of stroke, particularly in our minority populations here in Oregon, and it's a real concern. Children exposed to secondhand smoke are at increased risk for sudden infant death syndrome, also a problem in Oregon and across the country, but particularly here. Lower respiratory infections, severe asthma, and slowed lung growth. And children who grow up in homes where they're smoking are more likely to smoke themselves, so we're obviously concerned about that as well. So there's not only the human impact of smoking, but these are also very costly. They're very expensive to pay for the diseases associated with smoking, and we spend more than $1 billion in direct medical expenditures related to smoking-related diseases in this state every year. And there's some more data in here. The second page that I had attached to my testimony is related to tobacco taxes that have recently been passed by our surrounding neighbors. Our cigarette tax is currently 118, which is 28th in the nation. New York is the highest. And several of our neighboring states have recently increased their taxes, including Washington, which is significantly higher than ours at $3.25, Utah, New Mexico, and Hawaii. Idaho and Nevada are currently considering a dollar increase as well. I was actually just with my colleagues yesterday in Seattle. We were talking about several states looking at this, and I know that folks across the country are looking at increasing taxes as well. So really appreciate your time today, and just want to reiterate that these diseases and the impact of smoking has tremendous human toll on our community, and it's also a huge economic burden, and I urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we'll hear the whole panel and then invite questions.
Good morning, Co-Chair Berger, and he's not here, former other co-chair and members of this committee. For the record, my name is Brett Hamilton, and I'm the executive director for the Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon, Incorporated. Briefly, TOFCO Partners is a statewide coalition of organizations committed to reducing tobacco-related morbidity and mortality through statewide policy changes that decrease tobacco use and exposure to tobacco byproducts. The coalition and its partners include the American Cancer Association Society and Cancer Action Network, Heart Association, Lung Association, Northwest Health Foundation, Upstream Public Health, the OMA, ONA, and others. And so I come representing them today. What I'd like to do today is, I think you hit many of the points, but I'd like to go back to some of the testimony from last week, and I would like to touch upon some information that that I think had some seeds of truth, but I would like to talk about them more fully. First of all, every state, including Oregon, which has ever increased its tobacco tax, has received more revenue than would obtain absent of the increase. So tobacco tax does increase revenue. While this is true, higher revenue levels obtained from cigarette taxes will decline over time and smoking rates continue to go down and revenue changes will gradually be unpredictable. So there will be declines, but that's of the great work that our state program does in getting people to quit smoking and preventing new people from smoking, especially youth. And in fact, the cigarette tax and overall tax revenues are much more predictable and stable than state income tax or corporate tax revenues, which can decline sharply during recessionary periods. My second point is the opposition refers to the Master Settlement Agreement and the excise tax as government profits. This characterization is just wrong. First, the Master Settlement Agreement is a reimbursement from big tobacco to states to recover from their past tobacco-related health care costs. And that was just marginally reimbursement. Second, the excise tax is used to pay for current tobacco-related health care costs, plus it funds our state programs to prevent tobacco for prevention and education. I also like to talk to the fact of the cost of a tobacco, and our position spoke of it being $5.41. Well, let's really talk about cost here. A true cost of a pack of cigarettes is $13.27. When you take in the cost of health care costs, And those are the direct costs, the indirect costs, and that's not even including the loss of productivity from employers have for their staff being ill and taking smoke breaks and other things. So that's the true cost if we're really going to talk cost. And lastly, I would just like to state that increasing Oregon's tobacco tax is a win-win-win. It's a win, health win, it reduces smoking, it saves lives. It's a financial win because it does raise revenue and reduces health care costs. And it's a political win because this is a popular vote, and people in Oregon support this. Even those who we refer to as Oregon smokers in the profile, 58% support increase in tobacco tax. So TOFCO is a coalition, and its partners will urge this committee to act in the best interest of our children and all Oregonians by supporting an increase in the state tobacco tax. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Raquel Bornanesque, and I'm co-director of Upstream Public Health. It's an organization dedicated to improving the health of all Oregonians. And today my testimony will be a quick Q&A. Question, what industry forces Oregonians to pay over $1 billion in health care costs each year, yet is trying to block a dollar a pack tax? Answer, tobacco. Question, what industry claims that this debate is about personal choice, but has been convicted of racketeering and manipulates nicotine levels to keep people addicted? Tobacco. Question, what industry in testimony last Thursday declared tobacco taxes regressive, yet does everything they can to keep low-income people addicted? Again, tobacco. We know the goals of the tobacco industry. That's hardly been a secret. However, your job and my job are to do what's best for the residents of Oregon, and together we can stem the tide. Question, what state has double the rate of smoking during pregnancy compared to California? Answer, Oregon. In what state do kids smoke over 7 million packs of cigarettes every year? Answer, Oregon. Question, what state legislature recently passed a $1 a pack tax that wasn't challenged within the initiative process by the industry and had overwhelming public support? Answer, Washington, and Oregon can be next. In the next legislative session, we too could be patting ourselves on the backs for reducing Oregonians' tobacco use. And for the last question, who has the opportunity to stand up for what's right for Oregonians' health and declare we are taxing cigarettes because it's good for health and good for the economy? The good news is this committee has that opportunity. The train is clearly moving on this issue. And let's not forget that the Oregon legislature has made great progress reducing tobacco use. This committee knows what works and knows how to get things done. Picture an Oregon free of death and disease due to tobacco. The bills before you today are an important step in achieving that common goal. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Thank you for coming, and thank you for coming a day after. We have a couple more. Michael Novick, I don't see him here, but he signed up. Mary Lou Henrich? Don't see her.
She's running late.
She's running late. Maybe a little. Mark Nystrom. No. Commissioner Bill Hall, Lincoln County. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs Berger and Barnhart, members of the committee. The Association of Oregon Counties supports the three bills under consideration, but suggests keeping the revenue allocation formula in its current form. You've already heard about the true costs of tobacco to the state. The Oregon Tobacco Prevention and Education Program is a best practice, with the state and local public health systems working in coordination on a comprehensive program. There has been a 48% reduction in per capita cigarette consumption since Oregonians voted to raise the tobacco tax and fund the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. I'd like to talk briefly about the background of this shared revenue source. The Oregon cigarette tax began in 1966 with a share for cities and counties. It taxed 4 cents on every standard pack of cigarettes. This provided 1 cent per pack each to counties and cities to offset the costs of state mandates, compensate for preemption of local taxing authority, and partially offset city fire suppression and county public health costs. The result was a 50-50 sharing between state and local governments. As part of this joint proposal, local governments agreed to be preempted from levying local cigarette taxes and agreed to rely on the state for stewardship of the revenue source on behalf of both state and local governments. As we know, the permanent tax for a standard pack of cigarettes right now is $1.18. The state general fund receives 22 cents, Oregon health plan 85.7 cents, cities 2.3 cents, counties 2.3 cents, distributed to each county based on population. The Department of Transportation receives 2.3 cents, and the tobacco use reduction account receives 3.4 cents. Counties see two streams of revenue in the current allocation formula. The county portion of the tax is used to support county general fund services, including sheriff's patrol, jails, health services, and general government services. The counties also receive a portion of the tobacco use reduction account through their public health departments. These funds are designated to be used for the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mary Lou, we're glad you arrived. Take a big breath, and you're on.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Mary Lou Henrich, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Public Health Institute, an independent, nonprofit, non-governmental organization with a mission to improve the health of Oregonians through effective public health policy and programs. Knowing that health begins long before illness in our homes, schools, and workplaces, we focus on evidence-based policies that help to create places where people live, learn, work, and play that make it possible for Oregonians to make the healthy choice the easy choice. I'm also a member of the Oregon Nurses Association and the OEB Board of Directors, and was the founding CEO of Care Oregon, Oregon's largest OHP managed care contractor. So I come at this issue from a long time. Having been a public health nurse administrator for the past 40 years, I can remember days when physicians and nurses advertised cigarettes while wearing their white coats and uniforms. This certainly was marketing unhealthy choices as the cool, sophisticated, medically sanctioned choice. We then tried to educate our patients when we learned about the dangers of tobacco and the public about the negative and deadly health outcomes as the result of smoking. We didn't see much change, however, in the rates of smoking after many years of that educational approach. It was only after a comprehensive population and environmental change approach was taken that we began to see dramatic decreases in smoking. Laws that taxed tobacco products and increased their purchase price was proven to be one of the most effective strategies to deter many, especially youth, from becoming addicted to tobacco. So I'm not going to go in and read all of my testimony, but what I want to come to is some rebuttal to last week's testimony from the tobacco industry, where you heard about how regressive this tax is. So what I'd like to have you look at is the last page of my testimony. It's a chart that actually shows what is really regressive and the causes of death that impact low-income populations are the real regressive parts of tobacco. So there are about 7,000 deaths each year that on their death certificate are linked to tobacco. They directly linked. They are cancers of various types, cardiovascular diseases, respiratory diseases. Now, of those nearly 7,000 deaths, Mark Nelson told you that 57% of Oregon smokers are low-income households, less than $35,000 annual income. So therefore, 57% of those deaths, which is almost 4,000 of them, are to low-income Oregonians and persons of color. So that's what's regressive. These many low-income residents also often rely on tax-supported programs such as Medicaid, Medicare, Veterans Administration for health care coverage, or they are uninsured and therefore contribute to the cost shift that is driving up the annual cost of private health care coverage for employees and employers. And we're all worried about how we're going to contain these costs. Yeah. So, yes, low-income Oregonians are bearing a heavier burden of illness and death due to tobacco products. And the average Oregon taxpayer, like you and me, is bearing the burden of increased cost of government-supported health care and our higher insurance premiums. So, ultimately, passing the tobacco tax increase of at least a dollar a pack and dedicating some of the additional revenue to tobacco prevention and cessation services to help these low-income Oregonians and all of us can begin to narrow the mortality gap between lower and higher income Oregonians and decrease spiraling costs of health care for all of us. It's the disease, disability, and cost of tobacco-linked diseases that are truly the regressive part. The rest of my testimony, I think you can read and probably reiterate some of what my colleagues have said. And thank you for being understanding of my morning.
No problem.
Any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you
and,
very much.
thank you for coming, rushing in, and we are glad you got here in time. Without further questions from the committee, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2110,
22.
Oh, we have more signups. I'm sorry, I'm not closing them.
Withdraw all of that.
I'm going to keep them open.
My bad. And I apologize to whoever's on this list or who else might have wanted. Ralph, this is the second time I've done this to you. Okay. Ralph Groner. Okay. And Taj Suleiman. Taj, come on up. I apologize.
Thank you for
coming up. And Ralph Groner, who did show up. Taj, go ahead.
Chair Berger, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee. My name is Taj Suleiman. I'm a graduate student. I'm a citizen of Oregon. And I'm addicted to smoking. This is my first time. I admit that. I've been smoking for about 6 years. And I used to have a good, healthy lifestyle, swimmer, runner. And I have tried and failed about 4 times to quit. The longest period of quitting was about 3 weeks, but the addiction was still there. I also tried to change cigarettes brands as what's normally, you know, some of them are organic and non-addictive. And I've tried all of them and considered less harmful. But they were all traps. They're all traps to me, and not really did not bring me the closer to quitting. I cannot really afford the cost of cigarettes yet. I urge you today to increase the tax on cigarettes. Raising the tobacco tax is the best way to help me, to help all smokers quit for good. That's why the tobacco industry opposes tobacco taxes. The industry claims that tobacco taxes are regressive and will hurt low-income Oregonians. But we know tobacco industry marketing is regressive and hurts low-income Oregonians. We know tobacco-related health that related to death and diseases is regressive and hurts low-income Oregonians. Please provide smokers a better, healthy life, raise the tobacco tax, and support the majority of smokers who want to quit. Thanks for listening.
Taj, thank you very much for your testimony, and please keep trying. I did it. You can, too. Quit smoking. Mr. Groner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing ASME, that's American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I'm winded running down the hall, and I quit smoking right here at this building 21 years ago, so I shouldn't have been. I'm going to support in behalf of counties 2533, and it allows me an opportunity to say we made a commitment last session to help counties out because Measure 50 is discriminating significantly against one form of government in this state, and that's county government. And counties are literally reeling as we talk here today. They have bills in to take money from federal forests to use it for sheriffs, etc. The reason I support 2533, and I realize it doubles from 2.3 to 6.1%, the tax. I actually would have supported the bill for counties to have the right to go out for a cigarette tax. We face as a legislature and as a state the problems not of this session, especially in many of our counties that are timber related, of losing programs so significantly that the state will, and already is, taking them back. Programs such as seniors out of my county, Clackamas, programs such as county mental health, programs that they no longer can afford, including Lane County, including Clackamas County, statewide. So I'm out of desperation signing up to support the only tax I see that actually could significantly help counties survive Measure 50, which has no floor. Five does. We could live with five. We cannot survive much longer with Measure 50, as well as the timber economy lacking and significant economic growth from that. So I'm forced, as a county union, AASME represents a vast majority of cities and counties in Oregon. You notice I didn't mention cities. They're hurting as well. But not to the degree counties, since they provide human resource programs for the state. Only two cities provide human resource, three cities, I'm sorry, Salem, Eugene, and City of Portland really have significant amount of money that goes to human resource programs outside of state dollars. Those are all my counties they're in as well. Remaining counties in Oregon do not have those kinds of funds, and I have to stand up and say we have got to do everything we can to help counties weather what I call the Measure 50, the 3% cap storm. So thank you for this opportunity to stand up for counties and local government. I hate to do it on the back of cigarettes, but I really don't have a lot of other options. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Questions for either of these gentlemen? Thank you very much. And now, is there anyone else who didn't sign up or who would like to speak? I'm doing my due diligence, which I didn't do before. Okay, now, Carol, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2110, 2231, and 2533, and I thank you all for your testimony on these bills. And we're next committee going to take up, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2476, and Christine, I think, is going to explain this to us.
Good morning, Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. House Bill 2476 comes from a subsequent referral from the House Committee on Agriculture. The process by which the assessor obtains a value for each class of farm use land has been required by law to be done in conjunction with the Farm Use Advisory Board. However, the Government Efficiency Task Force established by House Bill 2920 in the 2009 session has looked at this process, and they found that the approaches between counties can vary widely in their consultation with their Farm Use Advisory Board. In some cases, counties have trouble finding people to serve on the board, and the assessors will obtain these values outside of that process. So House Bill 2476 would remove the requirement that assessors work with the Farm Use Advisory Board in order to come up with these income approach factors for various types of farmland.
Questions for Christine? Thank you. We have a number of folks, and I'll bring you all up together, and you can decide what order. Douglas Schmidt, Sarah Miller, and John Phillips.
Good morning, Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Policy and Planning Division Administrator at Business Oregon. As you know, House Bill 2920 created the Governor's Task Force on Efficient and Cost-Effective Service Provision to study the overlap of services between state and counties to provide. There were five work groups established in the task force: assessment and taxation, human service, public safety, elections, and county services planning. I participated in the assessment and taxation subcommittee. That subcommittee studied the property tax system and consulted with the Department of Revenue technical staff as well as county assessor technical staff to identify enhancements or efficiencies that could be made. In addition to me, that task force was chaired by Elizabeth Harchenko, former director of the Department of Revenue, had representation from Governor Kulongoski's office, Denny Doyle, the mayor of the city of Beaverton, sat on it, Clark Balfour, representing the Special Districts Association, and Judy Shiprack, commissioner from Multnomah County, all sat on the subcommittee. We held 5 subcommittees where we were in consultation with our technical advisors, as well as had a public hearing process with members of the general public providing testimony with regard to certain recommendations. I think it's important for you to understand that my role in the subcommittee was really to be a non-stakeholder interest. I frankly probably knew least about the property tax system of anyone who served on the subcommittee, and I know more about property tax than probably makes sense for my day job and continue to come testify for Representative Nathanson for bills that have resulted from the task force. But I really viewed my role as the person in the subcommittee who asked the question, does this recommendation make sense, right? I was essentially the Jane Q. Public representative and frankly asked a lot of times our technical staff to explain it at a level or challenge recommendations at a level to make sure they made sense from a public policy perspective. I think the resulting bill that you have in front of you, 2476, is one of those recommendations that makes common sense. It essentially allows a county assessor to convene a farm board for review of farm values, but removes the requirement to do so. It provides assessors flexibility to do something if it adds value to a process, but not just to have process for process sake. It's important for me that you know that I'm a passionate public servant, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to work on the Governor's Efficiency Task Force because I think there are lots of opportunities to improve the effectiveness of government service delivery. As an Oregonian taxpayer, I hope this bill can be the beginning of a long conversation that we have about things we can do differently, particularly when we work together. And I'm really excited that we got out of farm ag with a unanimous referral, and I learned more about integrated disease management and integrated pest management, which were the bills that got heard right before this bill in front of that committee. So tobacco tax today I learned about before I'm here with you, and so.
And welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, and I was a member of that work group, and I think Sarah's covered most of the background, and Doug knows the details, so I'll just finish by saying that we did talk with the Farm Bureau and the whole Ag Committee, and the Farm Bureau wasn't sure what this board did at first, but we had some good conversations, and they understood that that this is not a huge policy change. It's not a big thing in the overall scheme of things, but it's just an efficiency that we can do, grab a hold of, and make less inefficient effort out there in the county. So I'll let Doug get to the details. So thank you.
Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Doug Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor, and I'm here today to testify in favor of this bill. Real briefly, the Farm Board will review the rents that farmers pay on specific farmland based on their quality of the soil. That rent then is converted into a value, especially assessed value, that is put on the roll. The counties have to do the research of contacting farmers to get the rents, to calculate the values, and there's a specific formula that the legislature has laid out in statute of the cap rate that we use to convert that rent into a value. So that is the only variable is the rent, really, and we present that to the Farm Board each year. Polk County does convene a Farm Board every year. It does require us time and money to convene the board. We have to publish it in the paper as an open meeting, public meeting. We have to compile the report, take minutes, compile the minutes, and have them ready for the board to review next year. By making this optional doesn't mean that I'm going to eliminate the Farm Board. Some counties have said that they will continue to convene the Farm Board every year. I may not do that. I may do it every few years just to validate and verify that the rents that we are collecting are correct. From what I can remember, we have never had an appeal from a taxpayer or a group of the values that we have put on specially assessed farmland or our report. Neither have we had a taxpayer come in and appeal the specific farm value we have put on that property. This is a specially assessed value. It's not the market value that's on the property. That's a whole nother study we do that isn't reviewed by any board. This would save us time and money, not a significant amount, but any efficiencies that we can get at the assessor's offices would be greatly appreciated. My staffing level was just cut by about 10% for the next budget cycle. So we are looking for ways to create efficiencies in the assessor's office, and this is one way. We still will continue to collect the rents. We have to do that in order to put the values on the roll. It's just that we would not have them reviewed every year by a convening board. Again, I thank you for allowing me to testify. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them for you.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on Section 1-1 of the bill, and this is a public process issue. I'm not familiar with it, and I absolutely agree with removing processes that don't help. But this moves from the board, which is to exist, to now that the board is appointed at the request of the county assessor for purpose of advising. And that now puts control on the county assessor for determining when a board shall be established. Who besides the county assessor would benefit from having this board? Would the taxpayer, might there be a time when the taxpayer might benefit from having this advisory board?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, Vice Chair Brewer. The public could, the boards that I remember, we've never had a member of the public attend the meeting and ask any questions about the studies that we've done. The benefit or detriment might be that our rents are off by just a slight amount. We have had the board change our rent slightly, but at the most it's been a dollar or two per acre. On a $100 rent per acre, they may have adjusted it just slightly. I don't know that there is any major benefit. I may be talking out of line here, but any major benefit of having the assessor choose to convene the board or not.
Thank you. I did have one follow-up then, and it's mostly because of my lack of familiarity with this board. Would there be opposition having it appointed at the request of the county assessor or county commission so that a taxpayer could convene this if they felt necessary, or a group of taxpayers could? This is more from a public process policy perspective.
John, do you have any thoughts?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mayor Brewer, that's certainly a possibility. Yes, the reason why the bill does speak to it the way it does is because it does make the convening of the board completely at the discretion of the assessor. So it does insert the word may there, and then the assessor would have the sole sort of control over that. The question is whether that information is useful in every case, or whether it's even possible, because in conversations I've had with assessors in Umatilla and Morrow and Josephine and Clackamas, for example, the Clackamas County Assessor was here to testify before the Ag Committee, and he said he's had a farm board for many years, but the last 2 years he could not get anyone to serve. So even if you require it, or you acquire it as a matter of the commission through a public request, if the farmers are not willing to serve, that puts the assessor in a difficult position of having to have a board but not being able to convene one. What Umatilla County has told me, the assessor, is that they have a farm appraiser who is very active because of the nature of the agriculture, and that that county, and agriculture is different in different counties. And so in that particular county, that farm appraiser is out talking to farmers, they're out looking at farmland, they're talking to them about their rents. And so that convening a farm board will tell him what he or she already knows. Also, what you'll have in a lot of cases, if you have a 10-year lease on farmland, you know the income levels for 10 years. You don't have to convene it every year to find out that same value, that same income stream. So, some of this information is just not useful on a year-to-year basis. So I guess you could have a member of a public ask for it, but I think it would be more likely that a member of the public who might be a farmer might say, I think my value is too high and I'm going to appeal it, which hasn't been happening.
This is real briefly then. So the public still has some redress through the appeals process, even though they don't have control of this board.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the committee, I would note that this was referred to us from with a due pass recommendation from the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, which would presumably have a lot more knowledge about the workings of this than we do. I'm not sure why it was recommended to us by prior reference, because I'm not sure if it has any revenue implications, but we are certainly getting a lesson in farm boards. Further questions to this panel? Thank you very much. I have no one else signed up. Is there anyone else who is dying to talk about farm boards?
Madam Chair, the record that Polk County has seems to be continuing here.
What?
Nobody shows up for the meeting.
Oh.
No members of the public are interested in this board.
That is a groaner, Mr. Chair. With that...
I thought he left, Madam Chair.
Groaner? We're having way too much fun in the Revenue Committee. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2476 and give the gavel over to my co-chair to finish the meeting. He was supposed to have started, and he signaled us we was late, but my phone was turned off. With apologies.
Well, thank you. And Madam Chair, I didn't realize I was supposed to be running the meeting today since I had the last one. But
well,
that's fine. We have a couple of work sessions, so let's open a work session on House Bill 2569. And who's on that one? Is that one yours? Okay. Well, why don't you describe the bill for us? And I think it looks to me like we have a couple of amendments. Why don't you describe those as well?
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. House Bill 2569 today has a -2 and -3 amendment for consideration. The fiscal impact statement has come back on the two amendments with no expenditure impact. And there is an indeterminate revenue impact on both of these amendments. The effect of the amendments would be that they have clarified a number of technical issues with the bill. For appeals that affect property in multiple counties, the individual assessors have the option to issue the credit for the portion of the property that's in their particular county. It clarifies the amount at issue is the real market value or the specially assessed value. It removes the provision that allows the deferred billing credit to be issued on property owned by separate taxpayers and adds a provision that deferred billing credit may only be issued in a property tax statement as well as in a separate notice of deferred billing. This would become necessary in cases where the deferred billing credit might be issued in multiple years and it would come out on the tax statement in subsequent years. Amendment also clarifies that the amount of tax in the tax statement, or it clarifies the amount of tax in a deferred billing credit that was delinquent before the credit was issued will not be delinquent once the credit is issued and the appeal is resolved. It allows a 45-day period from the date of the mailing of the notice for the taxpayer to pay any outstanding tax if an appeal is unsuccessful. It has a requirement that the assessor issue a quarterly report to the governing body of a county if there are any outstanding deferred billing credits. And it provides that any additional taxes payable upon the resolution of appeal receive a 3% discount if paid on time. And the difference here between the -2 and -3 amendment, both would address that list of technical issues, but the Dash 3 amendment would limit the amount of deferred billing credit to 80% of the tax on the value that's being disputed in the appeal. And so that offers an option between the Dash 2 and Dash 3.
Thank you. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you looking for a motion?
Yes.
I would move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2569.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2569. Discussion? Representative Brewer.
I object.
I'm sorry?
I object to Dash 2. And for discussion purposes, I am supportive of Dash 3, which is the 80%. Deferred billing credit, and the reason for that is that levels the playing field between both the taxing authorities and the taxpayers during the appeals process, stops it from running too long. Neither side is motivated to elongate the appeals process. Both are motivated to get to resolution, and for industry to put in 20% cash skin in the game just demonstrates how meaningful this is. Very rarely does a taxpayer want to voluntarily pay cash into any system. And I think that speaks to the merits here. And that was one of my main concerns from the very beginning, was that this removed any taxpayer protections by giving 100% deferred billing credit. And that's why I do not support Dash 2 and do support Dash 3.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
A technical question here from staff. Dash 2 and Dash 3 are the same except for the 80%. Is that correct?
That
so supporting Dash 2, you can support Dash 2 and support Dash 3.
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, it would depend on whether you supported the 80% limit on the deferred billing credit or not.
Okay.
But those otherwise, yes, they are completely identical.
Except the Dash 3 includes the 80%.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Other discussion? I think we better call the roll on the Dash 2 amendment. The motion is on inclusion of the Dash 2 amendment in the bill.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Delta.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Representative
Wong. Aye. Vice Chair Bailey. Aye. Vice Chair
Brewer.
Nay.
Co-Chair Barnhart.
Aye.
Co-Chair Berger.
Aye.
All right,
that motion carries.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
Move the Dash 3s into the bill.
Representative Wong moves the Dash 3 amendment into the bill. Discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
This is exactly like the Dash 2, but includes the 80%. Correct?
Right. And just to make certain that I understand it, what this would do, it would allow a deferral of 80% of the amount of the tax due, and 20% then would have to be deposited and would accrue interest during the time that the appeal was underway. Is that the effect of it?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, the 20%, if the appeal is successful, would be refunded with the 12% interest to the taxpayer.
Right. Okay.
Assuming that they had issued the full amount. That's a cap.
Right.
They could issue less than that.
Right. And under these amendments, either one of them, there's no interest accrues against the company should they, or the taxpayer should they lose, as long as they pay the tax in a timely way after the appeals are exhausted.
That is correct.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Wong.
Thank you. Just speaking to the amendment, I don't personally believe that our assessors are out trying to bilk taxpayers, but there also is a concept of trust but verify, and when the assessors get to make these types of decisions and put a lot of money at risk on behalf of our fellow taxpayers and job creators, I do think it's important for the assessor and the government to have some skin in the game as well. And so 20% is a number that was discussed and agreed upon by several folks, thanks to the good work by Representative Ira Brewer, and I think it's a fine policy.
Thank you. Representative Bantz.
This is a challenging situation, Mr. Chair. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to address it. It seems to me that the question is one of balance, and those in the business are the best suited to address it. What I've heard is that the counties are not in any way incented to place folks at risk. In fact, just the opposite. So I think this actually unbalances the situation. I'll be voting against it. It's one of those things, Mr. Chair, where one could go either direction, and I choose in this instance to look at the folks who are most challenged with collecting these monies and doing it the best they can and trying to see who has the most skin in the game. It's a tough one, and I appreciate the thinking on it that's gone into it, but I'll be voting against it.
Thank you. Other discussion? I think we better do another roll call. Again, this one now is on the Dash 3 amendment.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Gelser?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bailey?
No.
Vice Chair Brewer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barnhart?
No.
Co-Chair Berger?
Aye.
Now, that motion fails. And Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2569 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2569 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as amended with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Is there any objection? No objection. Motion carries. Who would like to carry?
Representative Wan? Oh, sure. I'd be happy to carry.
Are you up for it?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Sure. Representative Wan will carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2569 and open a work session on Senate Bill 305.
Senate Bill 305, you had a hearing on this last week. It comes to you from the Senate. There are no House amendments to consider. What it does is it gives the Department of Revenue the discretion for good cause to extend the payment period for people who have gone into the installment plan for the amnesty program. There's a little bit of discussion at your meeting last week about the revenue impact. And I can clarify that just a little bit, that, you know, our sense is there would be a small, really unmeasurable positive impact, and that's based on the notion that the Department of Revenue, given the additional flexibility, would make decisions to extend that time period in those cases where it's most likely to generate some revenue. The loss side of this, and there is a potential where you'll lose revenue, is that under the current law, with the hard date in the amnesty program, is that if people don't make that date, then they will be responsible for going back to the pre-amnesty penalties and pay. So that's the potential downside. Our assumption here is, and it's a subjective assumption, is that there will be, with the discretion the Department of Revenue has, there'll be a small positive revenue impact from that decision.
And we have all the paperwork?
You do, Mr. Chair. As I said, there's no amendments, so we have a minimal expenditure impact and also, in effect, a minimal revenue impact.
All right. What's the committee's pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 305 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill or Senate Bill 305A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection to the motion? Don't see any. Motion carries. All right. Who would like to carry this one? Or should we put it on the consent calendar?
No.
No. I thought I'd sneak one by.
Representative Gelser.
Representative Gelser will carry. All right. Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 305, and I think we're finished for the day.
Except to put on the record that your co-chair objects to any revenue committee bill being on the consent calendar.
Right. That's what that's what the grin was about.
Once again.
Representative Gelser.
Last session, wasn't the tradition we only put bills on the consent calendar on the days that Representative Berger was not here?
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes, that is correct.
That was the tradition, and I think she's avoiding that situation so that that's unlikely to arise. Let's talk about the schedule a little bit. Tomorrow, there's no
House Revenue Committee meeting. There is a meeting of the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. It'll be in this room, start at 8:30.
8:30.
So it should run. You've got a couple of bills. You actually have five bills that have been referred to the Joint Committee, and we've scheduled a public hearing on two of those bills, and then we'll do some work on you had asked to make some revisions around the work plan, and we've got that for you to discuss.
8:30 tomorrow, and then we meet next Thursday at 8 o'clock.
Thursday at 8 o'clock, regular time.
All right, well,
Thursday and Friday.
We'll all be here tomorrow at 8:30.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, the committee is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr.